alarming and massive. That's how the state consumer protector, Steve Levins, described the data breach reported by Starwood and Marriott on Friday. That launched investigations in several states. Levins suggested Hawaii consumers not wait until they get a letter or email from the company, but to be proactive to protect their personal information.
It's an enormous breach affecting over a half a billion accounts here in the United States and around the world. So people need to pay attention to what's going on with their financial information.
And what should we do?
Well, if you stayed at a Starwood property, you need to order your credit report right away to find out if there's any unusual activity in there. At the very least, you should change your password for your Starwood account. You should also seriously consider freezing your credit report, or if you don't want to do that, you can put a fraud alert on your credit report, which gives people a heads up that there may have been some improper activity on your account. It's a very serious breach. We're just getting to the bottom of it right now. We opened up an investigation here in Hawaii and several other states on the mainland. You know, we have a situation here where names, addresses, passport numbers, other sensitive personal financial information has been exposed, including, credit card information or other card information that was supposedly encrypted. It may have been unencrypted by the criminals who took it. We're not talking about a month of a breach involving a month or a few months. We're talking about 4 years.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's very alarming, and it's alarming that this was not discovered until very recently. So you have a huge company such as Marriott, and apparently the safeguards weren't in place to safeguard against this kind of activity, which is very alarming, and that's what we're going to be looking at.
I mean, it is distressing because it started with Starwood in 2014, and that was before Marriott acquired it.
That's correct. That's what is being reported right now. But we don't know all the information because the law enforcement authorities, such as my office and other attorney general's offices around the country, are just finding out about it. Other things that people really need to watch out for, I mean, bad guys are going to take advantage of this situation. So what's going to happen is people are going to get emails purportedly from Starwood or Marriott targeting people saying that, please provide personal information and we'll take care of this. Well, if you get an unsolicited email like that asking you for any kind of personal information, don't respond because it's going to be a scam. It's a phishing scam. Similarly, if you get an email and there's like a link attached to it asking you to click on this link and to enter personal information, it's also going to be a scam. They're going to be bad people trying to take advantage of the situation and extract personal information from people who have been already victimized by this breach. So consumers here in Hawaii really have to be very vigilant if they get these emails that are popping up.
Okay, so now what if you were a victim of a prior data breach?
I mean, if you're a victim of a prior data breach, what you should do is continue to monitor your credit report to make sure that the bad guys aren't continuing to exploit the breach. And one of the good things that you can do is you can freeze your credit report, and it's free, and that would prevent the bad people from at least preventing them from taking out additional credit in your name. And you should also periodically check your credit report for any kind of unusual entries.
So should you say maybe check it, what, once a quarter, once a month?
Well, under the law, you're entitled to get a free credit report once a year from the three major credit reporting agencies. So what we like to tell people is if you want to be extra vigilant, You can request a report every 4 months from each of the from one of the companies, so that way you cover it all year. And again, you can do it online, and it's free, and it's relatively easy to do. You go through it, look for any kind of unusual entries. People should also be checking their credit card statements to make sure that there aren't any unauthorized charges on it. I mean, the good news is that if there are unauthorized charges, if there are fraudulent charges on your credit card, federal law allows you to charge back, to take care of those those unauthorized charges. And if you do it within, if you're prompt in doing it, you, basically you're not going to lose any money. If you wait a period of time, the most you're going to lose is $50. So you need to check your credit card statements also. You do have to be vigilant. You can't rely, obviously, on other companies to guard this sensitive information, because these breaches are happening on a weekly, if not daily, basis from large companies and small companies. You know, these companies are using our data. They're using our personal information, and time again, it's not being safeguarded adequately. So consumers really need to step up and make sure that their data is not being used improperly. And one of the things that they can do to take care of that is, as I mentioned, check your credit card statements very carefully for any improper charges. Check your credit card, your checking account statements for improper charges or unauthorized charges or debits. And check your credit reports.
Okay. And then is there anything else that you think is important to note with this particular breach, besides just the sheer volume and the length of time that we were exposed?
Well, I mean, it's alarming because of, as you mentioned, the amount of time involved. And we still don't know the breadth of it. Marriott is unsure at this point, actually, whether credit card information has been breached. That's been taken. Apparently, it was encrypted, but they say that they don't know whether it was unencrypted, whether the key to unencrypt the credit card information was also taken. So I think you can make an assumption that if you charged something at a Starwood property, they probably have your information, and they probably also have your credit card information. So you need to make sure that you check your credit report, your credit card statements, and also seriously consider putting a freeze or a fraud alert on your credit report.
It is pretty stunning, though, to think that, you know, Marriott wouldn't have detected something.
Well, I mean, it's alarming. It's alarming that they didn't detect it, and this is something that happens all the time from, as I mentioned, small and large companies. The thing that's also alarming is why companies need to retain a lot of this information. I mean, if the transaction has already been consummated and the customer, they've already served the customer, there may not be a need to retain this information, because if you retain the information, it's going to be potentially exposed.
Yeah, it's vulnerable.
Yeah, and vulnerable to people who want to steal it. People shouldn't necessarily wait. I mean, you know, most people can figure out where they stayed. If they think they stayed at a Starwood hotel, they really need to step up to the plate and check their credit report, their statements, and, as I mentioned, seriously consider changing their passwords on their accounts, on their Starwood account, and also seriously consider putting a credit freeze on their credit report. Because if your credit report is frozen, no one is going to be able to take out credit in your name. So an identity thief is not going to be able to take out an additional credit card in your name, because they're not going to be able to no one is going to be able to access your credit report. If you can't access the credit report, no one's going to extend credit in that person's name.
Right.
So that's something that is a very valuable safeguard, and it's free now. It used to cost money here in Hawaii, but now it's free.
Steve Levins is Executive Director of the Hawaii Office of Consumer Protection. He was talking about the Marriott data breach affecting up to 500 million individuals. Marriott is our largest hotelier. And another development, New York Senator Chuck Schumer is calling on Marriott to pay for any new passports that consumers have to replace. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking back at a colorful and frequently controversial voice on local radio. At one time, he was reportedly the highest paid radio personality in the country. We say reportedly because details of this man's life, most of them provided by him, are, well, unreliable. What is certain is that he dominated morning airwaves for many years, despite his contrary nature. He played big band music when other stations played rock and roll, and he was known for his on-air practical jokes. He's most remembered by his rather unusual nickname and its abbreviated form. That's what we're looking for this morning. But listeners who also remember his real name, well, you go to the head of the class. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's December 3rd, and we're going to take a pause from regular programming for a test of the emergency alert system.
Well, I wake up listening to Morning Edition every day, and if I'm lucky, I get to listen to more than, 45 minutes before I have to head out to work. But sometimes I have really long drives in the morning up to the North Shore, and it's nice to kind of be comforted by today's news and some familiar voices.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chaminade University, committed to strengthening the community's counselor workforce. offering a master's in counseling psychology. More at chaminade.edu.
A new study recently released by the Department of Business and Economic Development and Tourism shows international students help to contribute close to $500 million to our state coffers. Dennis Ling, the administrator for the department's Development and Support Division, talks about this bright spot on our horizon.
Well, economic impact of $498 million to Hawaii's economy, which equates to $38 million in state taxes generated and supports 5,264 jobs, so it's pretty significant. If we were to compare it to another more well-known industry in Hawaii, the film industry is about twice the size of this, but you know, being this year, film industry has had a banner year, so half of that is tremendous.
So then, as far as the pluses for international students, how are we looking at that?
Well, Hawaii, we've established a consortium called the Study Hawaii Group. It's a group of 31 member schools who are committed to increase the flow of international students to benefit our state economically, as well as socially and culturally, and have joined with DBED to market Hawaii as an excellent location, education location, for international students. So that's a plus in our marketing scheme of things.
How long have we been tracking this?
Well, the study goes back to 2009, but there have been some years in which the studies weren't conducted. But we've been doing this study continuously since 2015.
I know there's been a big push by the state to really get those numbers up. And I believe last year we hired someone to recruit in Beijing.
Well, we have an office in Beijing, a state office in Beijing, that is concentrating solely on increasing the number of international students to Hawaii. But we've also joined forces with the University of Hawaii Manoa, who has a representative there also, who is also marketing the University Manoa campus in China.
So talk about the countries where we're getting these international students.
Well, the number one source of international students in Hawaii is Japan. We've gotten about 3,900 students, both long and short term. The second most important source is Korea, with 11.2% of the students, and China is third. So China being a very big source of students, we feel that that's where we should be concentrating our efforts to make sure that we get our fair share of students from China.
Right, and I believe last year we attended the graduation of a group of students from Japan under a special ambassadorship program. It was a short-term program.
Right. It was a short-term program. They were from Hiroshima. They came here to study at the University of Manoa. I think it was more of an English language program. But what we did was, at graduation, we made them ambassadors, student ambassadors for Hawaii, because they really took in the culture, as well as learning English, but they really took in the culture and lifestyle and some of the good things about Hawaii that we wanted them to share with their peers, both through social media or whatever means that they can to market Hawaii as a place for learning.
And this was a women's group.
This was a women's group. It was a women's school, yes.
So you've got then a mix of things in play, short-term
yes,
and long-term.
Yes. Of course, the long-term programs provide more student spending per student, but the short-term is important because it could transition into long-term study.
And how are we looking at students in the high school area?
Well, the high schools that have joined with the Study Hawaii Consortium include schools such as Iolani, Marino, St. Louis. So the private sector schools, high schools are very much involved in trying to increase their number of students. As for our DOE, exchange students are not counted in our numbers, and we don't include them in any of our studies.
I know some of the high schools had boarding programs, too.
Yes, yes. Iolani is kind of a leader in that, and St. Louis and Marinol and MidPac also have some host family type of situations, or do have some boarding opportunities.
How are those numbers? Have those numbers gone up, or have they just been pretty steady?
You know, we haven't checked those numbers about the boarding students.
Okay, so mainly we've been emphasizing the higher ed.
Right.
What can you tell us about the number four country, Switzerland?
Yeah, number four, that's interesting. I believe, although the survey is trying to be sort of anonymous in the responses from the different schools for competitive purposes, but I believe those numbers are from Hawaii Pacific University, so Switzerland is a strong market for them.
Yes, I mean, that's been their brand, I think, right, reaching out. They've got a very diverse student body.
Right, especially on the European side.
So that's interesting, though. But a large number from Switzerland, let's say, compared to the other countries in Europe.
Yes, yes, Switzerland. I can't figure it out, but I would think it's probably the weather, or they want something really different from what they're accustomed to.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right.
Despite the nationwide trend of less overseas students studying in the U.S., Hawaii's international student numbers have remained stable and, in fact, show a slight increase. And although we think it might have the current administration policies might have a dampening effect, we think we'll still remain strong, especially in our major markets of Japan, Korea, and China.
Do you see anything else out there on the horizon that might help us attract more of those students?
Well, I think as we grow our consortium together, the more we can as a critical mass market Hawaii as a place for learning, you know, that would be the strongest voice that we can use, because it shows that the schools together feel that what we have to offer is really beneficial to the international students.
And what's the feedback been like from the students? I mean, have they enjoyed their time here?
Well, you know, the feedback has always been positive, and we appreciate them being willing members of our ambassador program. We try to encourage each student who has studied in Hawaii from an international source to become an ambassador, and we've been very successful in getting them to be part of this ambassadorship.
Do you think there will be an ask for more money in the upcoming session just to help with the marketing efforts?
We will be asking for additional funding, and we hope that the legislature would support us.
We've been talking with Dennis Ling, DMED's Administrator of the Development and Support Division, about how international students help Hawaii's overall economy.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
It's now time for our reality check. It's a regular segment with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat, and reporter Marcel Henre is on the line with us with an update on Lime Scooters. Morning.
Aloha, Catherine. Good to be here.
So do we need to pucker up for Lime? What's the deal?
Well, it's going to be a little while before you start to see those scooters reappear, if they do at all. basically, what needs to happen is there needs to be a change in Hawaii's vehicle code. When the city got rid of these scooters, as you might recall, they appeared for a little less than a week back in May. They showed up kind of to everyone's surprise, and then they quickly disappeared when the city started taking action, impounding them, threatening fees and jail time and such. So Lime took a step back and temporarily suspended its operation, as they put it back then. And the city is classifying these scooters as mopeds, basically that there's no difference between those, you know, kind of the skinny electronic or electric scooters as there would be for that they're basically the same as the mopeds that you see going around in the streets, so that they would need to be registered. They would need to have safety checks. They would need to have license plates. And they certainly could not park up on the sidewalk, as you're seeing some of these scooters.
Right, because they do go pretty fast. I've seen them.
Yeah, they zip along, you know. The issue, though, is that there are, in other cities, these scooters, as other cities, you know, not just Honolulu, but all over on the U.S. mainland and even internationally, cities are trying to figure out how to deal with and regulate and handle these new transportation options and innovations that are popping up. But they have other classifications between just being a bicycle and a moped. And that seems to be the key problem in Honolulu and Hawaii as a whole, is that there's no classifications in the code or in the law between bike and moped. So for the time being, they're mopeds. And what needs to happen, if you're going to even see these scooters reappear, is there needs to be some changes on the legislative front. So what might happen, something I'll be keeping an eye on at least, is to look for whether there's any legislation going forward that allows for new categories where you could work with these vehicles and other types of emerging technologies to get around that are kind of alternatives to cars, basically so that the vehicle code can catch up to deal with these new technologies.
Talk a little bit about what other cities are doing, because I know you mentioned that in D.C., that they can't go very fast, right? There's a cap on the speed.
Yeah, there are caps. They're typically, I believe, around 15 to 20 miles an hour. And what cities are also doing in this initial year, really, that these scooters have popped up, is they're capping how large the fleets can be per company. You know, you have Lime, but you also have companies like Bird that are interested. And really, they started out, you know, as people say, you ask for forgiveness and not permission. They
yes.
came out with a real strategy of asking for forgiveness and not permission, where these things just appeared. So there's been a lot of playing catch up, and a lot of the rules in the pilot programs that have launched so far both cap the speeds but also the numbers of the e-scooters to kind of see what needs to be done. Different places are letting them ride in the bike infrastructure and the bike routes. Other places are not. So different cities are trying different things. And Honolulu is kind of watching to see how other places go, as they also they've formed their own group of private and public stakeholders. Lime, Bird, Uber, Lyft, Beaky, you know, the bike share. There are all these different stakeholders in the community that are currently part of what's called the Urban Mobility Working Group. And this group is looking to find the best ways. You know, rail isn't coming until maybe 2026, but they're looking at how you might integrate some of these scooters, e-bikes, you know, the bike share, how we can better make Honolulu streets work for some of these new ways to get around that are kind of alternatives to cars.
Well, I just know when we had the Lime representative in our studios, I told him these things look like toys, and I just want to spank somebody because they're just like everywhere, you know, with this Doctus technology. They're just being left seriously everywhere. It's a mess.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. I believe it's in Denver. The classification, when I talk about these cities having different classifications, they call them, I think it's quote-unquote toy vehicles is how they are classified.
Great.
In Denver. So really on the nose there.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much, Marcel. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Hi, I'm Melissa Price from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Genetic medicine is often heralded as the future of healthcare. It promises the ability to tailor medical treatment options based on an individual's genetic traits and environmental risk factors. But determining how specific genes impact health requires data, a lot of data. For the Department of Veterans Affairs, that isn't a problem. The VA provides healthcare service to more than 9 million veterans around the nation. Since 2011, more than 700,000 veterans have donated their genetic information to help the VA research the origins of disease and find new treatments. It's called the Million Veteran Program. In 2015, MVP became the largest human genome database in the world. Several thousand Hawaii veterans have participated. The conversation's Ryan Finnerty sat down with Gwen Anderson from the VA Pacific Islands Healthcare Center to find out more.
The Million Veteran Program is a national program right across the United States that is providing the veterans an opportunity to volunteer in a legacy project, in that the veterans are donating one tube of blood in order to contribute to scientific knowledge about the genetic aspects of health and disease. That's going to be incredibly important, not only for future veterans, but also for future Americans and our keiki, our children of the future, because the resource of the one tube of blood is providing us with a very, very rich research environment that will allow many, many researchers in the future to understand the diseases that affect veterans.
And why use the veteran population for this type of study?
The veterans are like the general population. They're men and women. They are of different ages. And they have the diseases that other people in the general population have. One of the unique features of the veterans is that they have been potentially exposed to things that the civilian population hasn't been exposed to. One example of that is heavy metals in the body. When I explored the research related to the effect of heavy metals on cancer, the one place I found the research was at the VA. The veteran population are unique in that regard. And then secondly, the veteran population, doesn't matter whether they live in Honolulu or in Florida, they move to Chicago, they move to Boston, they have an electronic healthcare record that follows them across a lifespan. So not only do we get to know them while they're young and beautiful and healthy, we get to also know them when they're older and still beautiful, but maybe not so healthy. And we get to see what they were diagnosed with, how we manage their illness by different treatments and interventions, and how they responded to that.
And I have to think diversity is another important factor, too, because people join the military from every part of the country, from every ethnic background, and that can probably give you a huge sample size, right?
We're talking two different things here. Sample size, I'll come to in a moment. And then the diversity population is absolutely important, because in any research concept, we want representativeness of the sample has to be representative of the general population that we want to then apply our research findings to. And I like to believe that that was one of the motivating factors, not only for myself as a local site investigator for the Million Veteran Program in Hawaii, but also the national team that gave approval for us to move forward in Hawaii. And that is that the state of Hawaii is known as one of the most ethnically diverse in the country. And in fact, we are adding to that diversity in the Million Veteran Program, not just by nationality, but also by gender. We have a very successful track record in Hawaii for recruiting women. And the women are really important, just as the men are. And yet we have a lower percentage of those in the general population of veterans. And it's important that they do contribute to the program so that we can study the diseases that affect women who've been in military service.
And so what types of discoveries can we, will we maybe see from this down the line?
Mm-hmm. So I had before me a publication that was just recently released by the Million Veteran Program. We've got 31 examples of how the current research that is being funded is going to have a direct impact on the veterans' quality of care and their quality of life. So one small example is prostate cancer. And that's critically important to Vietnam War veterans because they believe, and I'm speaking from their perspective, that their exposure to Agent Orange would have somehow impacted their risk for developing prostate cancer. So one of our studies is determining more accurately the difference between those veterans who have a slow-growing prostate cancer and those who have a more rapidly progressing prostate cancer. And so we're going to be able to save lives if we know the basic difference between those two groups.
So it's a gigantic longitudinal study. Basically.
It is. It's a very rich resource because we'll be able to do basic science. So for an example of that that was recently published is looking for the SNP, single nucleotide polymorphisms, single changes inside genes. Could be one of 30,000 genes. It could be 121 of the 30,000 genes that are the best genetic biomarkers or predictors of, in this case, the researchers were focused on smoking susceptibility. And that's important to us because veterans tend to be smokers. And so if there's some way that we can learn more about smoking behaviors, as well as whether or not those genes are not only related to smoking but all the other diseases that they could be at risk to, then that's an example of how we could do studies related to genetic biomarkers. We're also doing epidemiological studies. We can compare the risk of disease among veterans as compared to the UK Biobank, to find out if there's a difference in our population or if there's similarity in the population. So the availability of different kinds of research that we can do, the example of new screening tools such as what I described with the prostate cancer, can happen with lung cancer, can happen with breast cancer, many different kinds of diseases.
And eventually these techniques and this new knowledge will trickle down into the broader healthcare system and benefit everybody, correct?
There you're talking about what is the basic cycle of science. And so we've got those clinicians out there every day, day in and out, day and day, day one day at a time, 1 hour at a time, seeing a lot of veterans over a career. So they come up with some pretty amazing questions, and we want to give them the opportunity to form in teams of experts within the VA, but also at other universities who are centers of excellence for whatever information that would contribute to high-quality ethical science. So what we're doing is providing an opportunity for our researchers for a long time in the future to have the resources that they need to study the diseases that affect the most number of veterans.
And so, Gwen, if anyone out there is listening and wants to participate, how can they do so?
So look up the Million Veteran Program on the internet. That's the easiest way. There is a call-in number. They can call 866-441-6075. And that is the call-in center. They can speak with a live person, ask where there might be a Million Veteran Program in their area. They can learn more about the potential recruitment strategies in the future, which are now in the works, such as a web-based consenting process that we're working on. We're trying to expand and give more and more veterans an opportunity to participate.
All right, great. Well, Gwen, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gwen Anderson, the Pacific Islands local site investigator for the Department of Veterans Affairs Million Veterans Program. If you're a veteran interested in participating, call the VA Pacific Islands Healthcare Office or go to hawaii.va.gov. This is The Conversation, and I'm Catherine Cruz.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, an online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
It's flu season. Did you get your flu shot yet? Will it work? What should you do if you still get sick? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk about the current flu season and what to do if you or someone you love gets influenza. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
What does the end of the year mean to you? For me, I like to get my house in order so that I start the new year with a clean slate. That means paying all my debts and checking in with friends and family. If you spend time with HPR, consider making a donation to the station that's your constant companion. I promise you'll feel great. Give online at hawaiipublicradio.org or by calling our friendly membership team during business hours. Mahalo and Happy New Year!
In today's backyard quiz, we asked you for the name of a man whose voice and pranks once dominated Honolulu morning airwaves. He was born Herschel Hohenstein and changed his name to Hal Lewis, but listeners knew him as J. Akuhead Pupuli, or simply Aku. He got his nickname when an irate listener, upset because Lewis gave him the incorrect time, called him Akuhead on the air. And far from being offended, Lewis immediately adopted the moniker as his radio name. So despite Aku's reputation for April Fool's Day hoaxes, he was able to lure thousands of people to Waikiki one year for a parade that never came. He may have gone too far that time, but his appeal was based on his rascal personality, and listeners tuned in to hear what his next prank might be. And congratulations to Richard from Kapi'olani. You had the fastest fingers today. Our phone lines were ringing off the hook, but you got it right, and we had many fond memories from Aku's fans. If you have an idea for a quiz, do send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
This morning, HPR's Ku'uwei Hiraishi joins us to talk about a new book entitled Nā Wahine Koa. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
What's this right. all about?
Nā Wahine Koa, so the courageous women or the strong women. This is a look at the female leadership that popped up during the Hawaiian Renaissance of the 1970s. So got to go to the book release at Kawaiwai on Friday and actually meet some of these aunties. So Auntie Maxine Kaha'ule Leo, some of these names may be familiar to folks. Terry Keko'olani Raymond, Loretta Reedy. They were all sort of either on the front lines of protests, so evictions at Kalama Valley or those unsanctioned landings of Koho'olawe in the late 1970s. All in sort of fighting the land struggles that were going on at the time. This is a look at very unique female leadership role during that time. So
that's great that the book came out this year, because this is the year of the Hawaiian, right?
This is the year of the Hawaiian, and I think in speaking to the women themselves, hearing a lot about that national dialogue surrounding the Me Too movement and sort of female empowerment in general. And it wasn't timed out that way. This has actually come from years of collecting oral histories of these women and what they've done in their respective roles throughout the last 50 years, because some of them are still named in lawsuits against TMT and Mauna Kea, also against the fight over at Pohakuloa training area. So they are all still involved, which was nice to see, you know, these spunky 80-year-old, 70-year-old women talking about fighting the man. But I got to speak to Noilani Gadir Ka'opua. So she's an Indigenous politics professor up at UH Manoa. She helped sort of bring the book together and edited the book. But for the most part, it is firsthand accounts from these women of their journey in trying to figure out how to be a leader for their communities, for their families, for their husbands. So this is Noy sort of talking about what drove her to bring this book together.
Coming across so many young people who know the names of people like Walter Riddy and George Helm and Kimo Mitchell and Emmett Aluli, and they're completely important and their names should be known, but they don't know the names of the women who were on these same landings of Kaho'olawe and have been active in political life to this day. So the people like Auntie Loretta and Auntie Terry and Auntie Maxine, Auntie Moani. And that's really a driving force behind why I wanted to work on this project, because I feel like all of their names, all of their stories should be known.
Under-celebrated was the word that Gadir Ka'opua had used to sort of describe what she started to see as a professor up at UH teaching the history of Hawaiian activism on campus. But so this Ka'olawe, for folks who aren't familiar, was possibly the peak or the pinnacle of the entire Hawaiian Renaissance movement. And this was at a time when Ko'olawe was still an active bombing range by the U.S. used by the U.S. Navy. And folks like Walter Riddy, George Helm, and Emmett Aluli snuck in and got onto the island. They landed on the island along with some of these women, all of these women, in fact, that are profiled in this book. At one point had landed on Ko'olawe in the 70s as part of their sort of the beginning of them joining the movement. So that would, you know, when they landed, the U.S. Navy had to stop because they had to get them off. And sometimes they would occupy them for days on end and then they'd have to look for them. So it was the beginning of sort of demilitarization, I guess, for that movement.
I remember covering the day at Iolani Palace when they transferred the land over.
That's
and
right.
I think John Osorio was singing his famous song, and the governors were sitting on the front seat. And I remember I looked over and there was, you know, Governor Abercrombie and Governor Lingle. I know, you know, she was shedding a tear. It was just very emotional for lots of folks that were sitting there.
It was, and I think a lot of these women talk about how getting involved and getting active was really something that helped them heal in their own respective journeys. But got to speak to Auntie Maxine Ka'ulelio, who just turned 80 this year, still spunky as ever. But she talks a little bit about another role that she's seen for women. You know, it wasn't just being on that front line and being outspoken, but it was making sure that you're taking care of your family and the power that you have to create generational change by raising kids. And this is her talking about that.
But being a wahine, can you imagine our bodies? Can you imagine what we hold? We hold the foundation of success. How in the world did God pick us to give birth to a baby? How? But He knew our bodies were as powerful as the most deadliest storm, because we could take the pain. And that, to me, Navahinikoa is taking that pain. So I'm very, very proud to be called Vahini, the woman of strength.
So Gadir Ka'opua talks a little bit about how this activism, like I mentioned earlier, was a healing practice for a lot of these women. And Auntie Maxine in particular had a very good story about that.
That activism can be a healing practice, that a lot of times people think of activists as angry. But what their stories really highlight for me is how it's a healing for them. Auntie Maxine says, you know, she put her hand up to go to Kaho'olawe, and this was when she was a single mom raising 5 kids and a grandchild on her own, struggling for welfare rights, and she said, I'm going to go to Kaho'olawe. And these are the kinds of things that saved her, that healing the relationship between Kanaka and Aina, between people and land, between ourselves and our own bodies, you know, healing the violences in our communities, all those things are connected, and that organizing each other, standing up, rising up, having your voice out there is part of the healing process.
So it's the book itself is actually looks like a scrapbook. So if anybody gets their hands on it, there are pictures of these women in their struggles at the time with their kids in isolated valleys, trying to figure out what to do. It's a really interesting sneak peek into that time.
I remember the picture of Moani Akaka on the cover of another book, also tracing the origins of the Hawaiian Renaissance movement, Gary Kubota's book.
Yes.
And that was just released recently. So nice to have this back-to-back.
Exactly.
Release.
I think everybody's thinking about it. A lot of political activism going on in our communities right now, and looking back at this and what they've done is telling.
So it's nice to have that framework as we close out the year of the Hawaiian.
Exactly. Good point.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yes, thanks, Catherine.
That was HPR's Ku'uwehi Hiraishi. To find her stories, check out hawaiipublicradio.org. We do have to go, but up tomorrow, a new marine invader and why some scientists are sounding the alarm to do more to protect our coral reefs. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.